The New Testament makes it clear that Jesus wasn't interested in recruiting members for his club. He was in the business of making disciples, followers, whose commitment and love for him was personal and profound, and would, in the power of the Spirit, take on the world and change it. He also made it clear that following him would not be easy. I'm never very comfortable when passages of the Bible are rewritten or rephrased in order to be more inclusive, more politically correct or woke. Like when "I will make you fishers of men" is reworked to read, and Jesus said, "I will make you fishers of people." A woman once said to me, "If Jesus was the Son of God, why was he not a vegetarian?" The implication being that because in her eyes being a vegetarian took you very high up on the moral high ground, Jesus would have seen that, understood that, and made it his lifestyle choice. I would have been more wondering that if he was the Son of God, why did he not invent the bagless vacuum cleaner or the Apple Mac or discover penicillin or worry about the melting ice cap, pollution or the Amazonian rainforest? But we have to allow him to be who he was, a first century Palestinian Jewish man. Allow events to happen when they happened, where they happened, there and then, and not reinvent them by today's standards, see them through the lens of post-enlightenment, post-postmodern culture. You would indeed have every right to be very suspicious if the New Testament Gospels presented a Jesus so out of tune with his own times that he wasn't real. A Jesus who espoused every issue, concern and priority of 21st century Western men and women while walking the dusty streets of 1st century Palestine. I don't think so. Meanwhile, back at the Sea of Galilee, a location mercifully largely untouched by our pious, barnacled sense of history, whereby wherever there is a religious site made sacred by association with this holy person or that, this incident or that, well-meaning religious people can't resist the urge to build on it. A church here, a chapel there, cluttering up the holy moment with a clutch of devotional aids intended to focus, but just as likely to distract. But walk along the lakeside, walk on the shore, you can almost see the footprints in the sand. So much of the story happened by the lakeside. One of my favourite songs is Christa Berg's "Took a Boat Over Lake Geneva." I clearly recall the frisson and surprise, the delight of the first time I did precisely that. There I was, taking a boat over Lake Geneva. People around me wondering, who is this person, grinning like an idiot and singing, "Took a boat over Lake Geneva." But it's great having a lake. Even sitting in a traffic jam waiting to go over the Pont Mont Blanc is pleasing. There are things to look at, paddle steamers and pollarded plane trees. Things always seem better where there is water. It creates an ambience like little Greek fishing villages where gnarled old fishermen drink ouzo outside scruffy tavernas, a strange appealing mix of serenity and bustle. For nearly 40 years I ministered and lived in a fishing town, lobsters mostly prawns, but there were some bigger boats with great exotic names, Star of the Sea, Fisher Lassie, Lady Angela, Zephyr. And that distinctive harbourside smell of diesel oil and seagulls and cigarettes, nets sprawled, banter, amused locals watching the gawping visitors. The men, all men in those days, gruff, brave, no nonsense, no softies need apply. Because life out there in the water was tough and demanding, dangerous and deadly, and should you forget the risks those fishermen face on a daily basis, just down the road from Dunbar, you'll find the coastal monument to the Eyemouth fishing disaster. It reminds people of the price somebody paid for other people to enjoy a plate of cod and chips. The sudden windstorm in October 1881 blew up while the fishing boats were out at sea and caused the deaths of 189 fishermen, of whom 129 were from Eyemouth itself. Many of the fishing boats capsized, others were wrecked on the rocky coastline, stories of death and destruction and loss, the Eyemouth fishing disaster. The wide open sea is no place for sissies. The fisher folks were not easily impressed, not known for snap, hasty, emotional decisions. though it could be a financially rewarding life. New fishing boats are big business these days, cost millions. And in the fishing villages and towns of the east coast of Scotland, folk have nice houses and drive nice cars. Because when it's good, it's very good. People like fish. Back in those days, in first century Palestine, they needed fish. It was a staple. In Scotland, for all the hard living, often fishing villages were deeply religious communities, born naturally from a respect for the elements, the big sky. Lord, go with me, the sea is so big and my boat is so small. With Celtic Christianity indebted to the legacy of crazy journeys and skin-covered coracles, vulnerability taking on a whole new meaning. It wasn't just a job being a fisherman, it was a way of life. It was their way of life that bred a particular worldview, developed attitudes and priorities that were largely non-negotiable. Like when the fish were biting, nothing else mattered. Like farmers getting the harvest in. And you learn things out there on the open sea, the sudden capricious whims of Mother Nature. So we sing for those in peril on the sea with images of safe harbours and threatening rocks. It was this context, this world Jesus was addressing when he called the fishermen. Leave it all. Leave it all. Dare them to follow, find new priorities, learn a different mindset, work for a different kind of harvest. It might tell us something that Jesus chose the shoreline and the fishermen, not the college quadrangle, the bustling commercial centre, the divinity school, but the unfashionably ordinary. As Abraham Lincoln said, God must love ordinary people. He made so many of us. It spoke of a broad-reaching gospel. Whatever the kingdom of God was going to be like, it was not elitist or exclusive. We might want to wonder how that all changed and it became different, I don't know, more academic, more clergy-fled, more clergified, more at risk of being removed from reality. But the big question is, so what made them choose to follow? His charisma? Steely eyes that drew you in? That's how they show it in the movies. Or, as some records suggest, maybe they already knew him. The story was going the rounds. It was a small world. People talk. So this is the guy, huh? This is Jesus of Nazareth. It could all have been different. An on event, a damp squib. They could have said to him, hey, can't you see we're busy right now? We're literally up to our knees in work. Maybe later we'll think about it. They'll think about it, the death knell for decision. They could have wondered grumpily, who did he think he was? How very dare he breeze in here and try to disrupt our lives? It hangs in the balance. Nothing is certain. That's the beauty and the power of choice, our choice. Not all people who are called decide to follow. The gospel writer Mark is a big fan of immediately, straightway, at once. He uses these words a lot in his gospel because he wants us to understand that this whole story is urgent, important, crucial, existential, central to who we are and who we become. So, there it was, decision time. Go or stay. He's walking on. Go or stay. What if they'd said, as well they could have, well, no, not today, thanks, and carried on with their lives as if nothing had happened, as if he hadn't happened. And they'd heard about it all later, you know, as other people lived the story that might have been their story, those who chose to follow. Wasn't that the bloke who asked us to follow him that day on the beach? Didn't turn out well for him. We dodged a bullet there, lads. They would have lived different lives. Simpler lives, safer lives, longer lives, lesser lives, choosing not to be challenged by his truth, inspired by his teaching, astounded by his power, washed by his forgiveness, warmed by his friendship, blessed by his company, by choosing not to be with him. I remember a visiting evangelist came to our church in Scotland and posed this question to the young people. What happens, he said. What happens when Jesus comes into your life? Well, we all wanted to give the right answer. You're happier. You're stronger. You have more purpose and meaning. What happens when Jesus comes into your life is that Jesus comes into your life. What happens when Jesus comes into your life is that Jesus comes into your life. And as we know, we all have unfinished business with him. Because every day he invites us to follow him into our workplace, our connections, our conduct, our conversations. Every day we have the option to say, I'm too busy, I've got a lot on, I've no time to spend listening to your voice in my heart, calling me to walk your way, follow your lead. With the decision to be a disciple, there's a sense of beginning something significant, of growing in understanding, commitment deepening, discoveries made, development and changing views, opinions shifting and altering as new insights are gained, a visionary sense of purpose driving the enterprise, motivating all those involved and sharing the adventure that is the life of faith, that demanding challenge of following Christ, changed priorities ahead. But we need to remember too, the truth, the warning, the cost of discipleship. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. So imagine as you make your way out of church this morning and you go down the steps, imagine that there are crosses lined up in an orderly way, leaning over the wall, waiting to be collected by the disciples of Jesus, who have freely chosen to go with him and be his disciples, whatever the cost, wherever it leads. Imagine that collection of crosses waiting outside. And in your mind, in your heart, go over and pick one up. A way of saying, yes, count me in. I'm yours. This is who I am. Not just a member of a club. A disciple. The New Testament makes it clear that Jesus wasn't interested in recruiting members for his club. He was in the business of making disciples whose commitment and love for him was personal and profound and would, in the power of the Spirit, take on the world and change it. Thank you.